The Best of the Drive with Steve Jackson, a weekly one-hour recap of the best of last week's interviews with national newsmakers in politics, entertainment, and the arts.
So honored to be able to talk to our next guest. He is, of course, an American statesman, retired four-star general in the U.S. Army. He was the 65th United States Secretary of State under George W. Bush, and also the first, and to this point, only African-American to serve on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. His new book is called It Worked for Me in Life and Leadership. General Colin Powell is on the drive with us. Sir, thank you so much for taking the time. It's an honor.
Thanks very much, Steve. A pleasure to be with you.
All right. This book is fascinating, and we'll get into more of that in a moment. You're going to be at Herbst Theater tomorrow night in conversation with Colin Powell, correct?
Yes, I'm looking forward to it. We'll speak for about 50 minutes, take some questions, and then go on to a book signing.
Nice. Welcome to the Bay Area.
Thank you.
Early in this book, you talk about the importance of trusting your people. You tell a story about President Bush's first trip out of the country, and it happened to be to Mexico, and how you handled who would brief him on issues related to that country. Can you tell us a little of that story?
Well, I was a new Secretary of State with a new president, and I wanted to demonstrate to my staff at the State Department, the Foreign Service, that I trusted them, even though I'm new, they're new with respect to me. And so getting the president ready for his trip to Mexico, I told my staff one morning, my new staff, look, I would like the president to be briefed not by the assistant secretaries or senior people, but by the two most junior officers we have in the Latin American branch. And so my staff was a little taken aback, and they said, fine, when do you want to rehearse them? I said, I don't want a rehearsal. When do you want to see the slides that they'll use? I don't want any slides. I'm just going to bring the president in. He'll sit here. I don't want to even know the names of these two young people. I'm just going to put them before the president of the United States and tell him to go. And so I briefed the president on what I was doing, so he was witting of this all. And I wasn't worried because I knew that in the 3 days I gave him, these two kids, whoever they are or were going to be experts. They were going to spend 24 hours a day getting ready for this. Sure enough, the day of the meeting, the president came in, sat down. I turned the two young people loose, and they were great. The president asked them a few questions, thanked them at the end of the briefing, and he left. And everybody breathed a sigh of relief. But the real benefit for me is the two young officers went back to their office and told everybody. They called their mothers. They called their relatives. And it shot around the building. And what the message that went around the building was, hey, the new secretary trusts us. Look what he did. He trusts us. And they talked about it for years. But it was just a simple way of demonstrating that we're now a team. I trust you. You trust me. And as I say to so many audiences when talking about leadership, trust is the most important thing in human relations. It's the glue that holds an organization together, and it's the lubricant that keeps that organization moving forward. So if you want to know how to be a good leader, learn how to develop bonds of trust. Make sure that you are a selfless leader, never a selfish leader. Demonstrate moral and physical courage to your employees and followers, and they will start to trust you. And once they trust you and you trust them, they'll take care of you. They'll make you a success.
Well, if more people certainly went by that creed, this would be a better country, I think.
I think so.
Yeah, definitely. We're talking to General Colin Powell. General, in the book, you talk about how to work with the media, and you describe your time as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the conflicting obligations that you faced on what you could or couldn't inform the public on. And how do you balance that?
Well, that's where experience comes in, I guess. But I always felt that as a public servant and as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, answerable to the American people for how their men and women in uniform are being used, I had an obligation to tell them as much as I could about what we were doing. But at the same time, I had an obligation to protect those soldiers and not give away information that would put them at risk. The media, on the other hand, has an obligation to get as much as they can so they can inform the American people. And there has always been some tension between these two goals. But the two goals merge in that we're trying to inform the American people. And so I always tried to be honest and candid with the press. I always made sure that they understood I had an obligation to protect things. And generally, I had good relations with the press. Yeah. They knew when I couldn't tell them something, and they would back off after trying to get it out of me. And I tried to tell them as much as I could without breaking any of the confidences or secrets that they shouldn't know about. And I captured some of the rules in the section you're talking about. You know, never dissemble or lie to the press. Always make sure that you understand they get to ask the questions, but you get to pick the answer. Don't be forced into saying anything that you don't think you should say.
Right.
And remember, you're talking not just to the press. The press is not who you're talking to. You're talking through the press to the American people and to your enemies and to your allies around the world and to the family members who have their GI son or daughter in combat. And above all, you're also talking to those GIs, especially in the last 20 years with the advent of the Internet and computers. These young men and women are following closely everything that's going on that affects them. So you have to balance all of it and try to do the best job you can. Sometimes you'll be caught off guard, and sometimes something will happen that makes you unhappy, but that's the tension that exists in our wonderful democratic system.
General Colin Powell is our guest. His new book is It Worked for Me in Life and Leadership. And one of the fascinating, many fascinating parts of this book is your presentation, which you reflect deeply on in the book, to the United Nations in advance of the Iraq War. And you use that experience in the book to describe how to learn from failure. But can you give us a little of that backstory that you experienced leading up to that presentation in front of the UN?
Yeah, the backstory is that the intelligence community had provided a national intelligence estimate to the Congress in the fall of 2002, which was pretty categorical that the Iraqis had weapons of mass destruction, especially chemical weapons, and they were developing bacterial weapons. And on that basis, the Congress passed a resolution in the fall of 2002 by an overwhelming majority telling the president that if he couldn't solve it diplomatically, the Congress would support using combat power, using war, to get a solution. And the intelligence community provided to the president and to all of the cabinet and to our commanders that same assessment. The president didn't think the diplomatic solution was going to work. So in January of 2003, he had decided in his own mind that conflict would be necessary. And he asked me to present the case to the United Nations. The preparation that had been done for that presentation was not adequate. So I had to spend 4 days putting it back together and putting together something that the intelligence community stood behind. And so I presented that information. Some of it was right, but the most essential parts of it about the existence of weapons of mass destruction on the ground in Iraq turned out to be not the case. Even though the decisions to go to conflict had already been made, my presentation was the most vivid. It was the most symbolic. It was the most widely seen. And I've even had members of Congress say to me, no, it's because of your presentation that I voted for that resolution. I have to remind them, no, you voted for it 4 months earlier. excuse me, sir.
You know? Yeah.
But it was a huge disappointment to me because I thought what I was presenting we could stand behind, but it all started to come apart. And so in the book I tried to show that I accept it as a personal failure, even though I could easily say, you know, well, I just got bad poop. But I feel badly about it. It was a personal failure. It's a blot on my record. I get asked about it every single day and every appearance. And so the point I make in the book is it's a failure. I call it a failure. And now I've got to move on. I can't go fetal. Failures come to you in life. And I talk to young people especially who don't experience failure very much. I say, you got to get over failure. You got to keep going and accept whatever responsibility you have for that problem. And keep going. Don't give up. Otherwise, you know, you will suffer from the failure rather than learn from it.
Yeah, right. Did following that presentation to the UN, did the dynamic change at all between you and the president or vice president?
That dynamic didn't change between me and the president. I told the president when he made his decision in January that if he thought diplomatic action wasn't working and we needed to take military action, I would support him fully. He's the commander-in-chief and the president, and I thought it would be a rather simple military matter, not completely simple, but it would not be a difficult military matter to go to Baghdad and take out Saddam Hussein and the regime. But I was always concerned that the aftermath might be more difficult than others thought. some of my colleagues in the administration thought everything would just snap back together.
Right.
Well, it didn't. We didn't have enough troops on the ground to put security in place. We disbanded the Iraqi army, which was not what our plan was supposed to be, and we debathified the whole country, which took out a lot of the institutions that we were going to need and the professional people we were going to need in the new government. And so, as it turned out, years went by, the insurgency broke out. I left in early 2005 because it really wasn't working as well as it should as a team, and I thought I should be the first one to go since I was more different than the rest of them with respect to my views. And it was another 2 years before the president realized that he had to put a surge in, a surge that perhaps should have been there in the beginning.
Right. Do you still have contact with either Bush or Cheney these days?
I haven't seen Mr. Cheney in a while, and I haven't talked to him in a while, but the President Bush and I have good relations. We talk from time to time. I saw him the other day, and we had a handshake and a hug when his portrait was unveiled at the White House.
Yeah, saw that.
So we have a good relationship, and of course I have a good relationship with his father and the whole Bush family. I know them all. I've known them all for many years.
Right. General Colin Powell is our guest. The book is It Worked for Me in Life and Leadership. You described the Iraq War in terms of what became known as the Pottery Barn Rule. Can you explain that a little bit?
Very simply, when the president was considering what to do in the summer of 2002, as I mentioned earlier, I went to his private quarters in the White House and said, you really need to think about what comes after the fall of Baghdad. Don't see this simply as a military issue. Because once you take out a government, once you break this government, you're going to own it. You become the government under international law. 26 million people will be standing around without a government, and you have taken it out, so you have responsibilities. And he understood that, and he said, well, what do you recommend? I said, if we can, let's try to solve it diplomatically and go to the UN and put the heat on Saddam Hussein to fess up to what he's been doing. And the president did that. We got a unanimous resolution from the Security Council. But after some weeks of inspections and looking around, the president simply wasn't satisfied that the UN was going to find the answer we're looking for, and Saddam Hussein was just trying to escape U.S. sanctions. And that's when he decided that military action was required. And so the Pottery Barn Rule, which is really not a rule of the company, the Pottery Barn, if you break it, you own it.
Right.
You go into a shop and you break the china, you own it. They got mad because they said, that's not our policy. And I said, okay, but look at all the publicity you've got.
I saw you on TV last week, and the Mitt Romney came up. And
yep.
The fact that Romney recently said that Russia was our biggest geopolitical enemy or
foe,
yes, that's right. And you certainly don't agree with that. And
he didn't. I don't think he explained it. He just stated it.
Yeah.
And I have known the Soviet Union and the Russian Federation for most of my adult life. And the new Russian Federation of the last 20 years is not the old Soviet Union. And it's half the size, nowhere near the potential it once had. We have disagreements with the Russians. We have disagreements with our allies. And to think that the Russian Federation is going to be a foe either in a military or economic sense, it seems to me doesn't stand the test of analysis. And I was just trying to help Mitt with this by saying, you know, you got to think it through, Mitt.
Yeah.
And I didn't think he had. And I hope he really does start to take every opportunity to focus on these issues and really look at them in depth.
Apparently you're not going to make any recommendation or for president this year.
I don't think I said that. I'm just not going to say anything in the course of a book tour.
okay.
And I'm just a private citizen. All I have to do is vote in November. Whether I do anything else with respect to saying what I might or might not do remains to be seen. I always try every election to look at the candidates, but also their policies, the platforms of the parties, and who seems to be best qualified to handle the problems we're facing. I voted for Democrats and I voted for Republicans. Most of the voting I've done for Democrats was in the early part of my career, in the civil rights era, before I voted for President Obama in 2008. But in between, I voted for Reagan, I voted for both Bushes. So I've always tried to vote my my mind and my conscience for what I think is the best solution for the country at that time.
I know you're not really retired in every sense of the word, but life treating you good? You enjoying everything?
I'm having a great time.
Cool.
Enjoy traveling around the country on the speaking circuit. I meet so many different audiences, different people. I learn so much. And what I've learned more than anything else, Steve, is that the people out in the country are troubled by the problems we have, but they're still full of confidence and optimism. They still believe we can overcome. And so even though reading the news or just listening to the debates in Washington might kind of depress you, remember, we've always had problems in this country. We've never been without problems.
Sure.
And I've seen periods of our history in my lifetime far worse than this. And we overcame them.
Now, the book is It Worked for Me, in Life and Leadership, available now everywhere. He'll be in conversation tomorrow night at the Herbst Theater. General Colin Powell, it's just a real honor to talk to you, and I sure appreciate you taking this much time with us.
Thanks so much, Steve. I'm looking forward to being back in the Bay Area. As you know, I have interest in Silicon Valley, and
sure.
I just love that part of our country.
All right, well, beautiful.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
The best of The Drive with Steve Jackson.
And this is exciting. Joining us now is Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. Ooh. Many, many, many years as bass player and vocalist with Metallica. It's Jason Newsted and the Chop House Band. Yeah, let's play some songs, man. Okay, I got to ask you this. Can we get him on the regular mic? Because it'll be a little easier.
Hello.
There you go.
I'll lean into it, man.
Okay. Talk about a significant departure from Metallica and the bands that you've had in the past.
Mm-hmm.
What made you get into Americana and roots music like this?
The Chop House has been going for quite a few years, so we've played different styles for a long time, but not really ever in public. We played this kind of music with, parties and keggers and stuff for our friends and like that, but this is the first time we're bringing it out for the people, is
cool.
These shows right here. So we've always experimented with different styles of music, even though we spent the most hours with our forte of the heavy music, you know, but, this was always in my roots and my family and that, you know, listening to music through time and my parents' record collections and all that,
right.
Mamas and Papas and George Jones and things, so... There you go.
What's next, opera?
No, I don't think so. we really have played with many different styles in the Chop. There's been all kind of hip-hop guys and soul guys and full metal guys and rock people and turntablists and all these different things through the years. So we always try to mix it up as much as possible, mix up styles as much as possible.
Yesterday, according to my fine producer Mike DeWald, was the 28th anniversary of the release of the Metallica album "And Justice for All."
Really?
Your first album playing with them. See, you didn't even know that, but Mike knows it all.
Seems like a week and a half ago.
How did you wind up in Metallica all these years ago? And you were there for the heyday, really, in many, many ways.
Yeah, they were together as the original Metallica for three albums in about 3.5 years, and I joined in 1986 after the death of Cliff Burton in a bus accident, their bass player, and they auditioned a bunch of cats from all around the world, about 45 or 50 people auditioned over in Hayward, and I flew up from Phoenix where I was then with my band Flotsam and Jetsam, and came up and auditioned for those guys. They called me back a couple times, next thing you know, there we are. But actually 11 days after that day, that first audition day, we were playing a sold-out Budokan. And so I went from loading my Ford Ranger truck with my amp and stuff, Flotsam, and about actually 8 days later or something, playing a Budokan.
thousands.
Yeah, so that's 30 years ago in a couple months here.
Wow. All right. Again, the gigs coming up, and this is the first gigs for you guys.
Right. We've done a couple warm-ups, kind of around local stuff, and then we're doing these five. Actually, there is one that we missed in there, which is the 7th, Wednesday the 7th. We're playing in Santa Cruz at Moe's. Then we go to 8th, Sweetwater, 10th, Silos, 15th, and Sebastopol. Mm-hmm. We also have a free show this weekend, or a week from today, in Nevada at the Crystal Bay Casino. So we're doing five exclusive shows to share this fun stuff with everybody.
What about recording? I'm assuming you've been recording some of this.
We record everything, but we only have probably four or five originals we play together, and probably I have 10 or 12 written, so it's going to be a little while before we record that. I've really been collecting songs. That's the key right now, is just try to get
cool.
as many and go deeper and deeper in the years, back into mining songs and older songs and way, way back, and make our own versions of them, some well-known, some not so known.
Sounds great. It's Jason Newsted and the Chop House Band. Let's do another song on the Friday Drive Live.
All righty.
country, I'm gonna bury my head in a creek. I'm gonna jump into the water and baptize both of my feet. Because everywhere I'm walking, I'm a stepping into trouble deep. Hey, yeah. I'm going down to the river, gonna wash my soul.
Unbelievable. You know, if people, listeners didn't hear the crowd here, I think they would assume we were playing records. You know, this is not a CD. This is live in the studio. My God. Jason Newsted and the Chop House Band, Joe Ledesma on bass, Rob Tucker on percussion. Joe, what's it like playing bass for Jason Newsted? After all his years of as being a bass player.
Pretty awesome. Good bass mentor.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. You thanks, guys, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us, man.
Jason,
really
great to meet you. So great much. To meet all you guys.
Everybody. Thanks, everybody.
Beautiful.
Join us again this time next week for more of the Best of the Drive.